options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Hello, I'm Daryl Jones, Director of Research at HedgEye. Welcome to, I think, the fourth edition of our new webcast, In the Arena. Very excited today to have Rick Abeda, as I know him, or Enrique, as some of you on Twitter know him, just launched his own investment research business. Also, interestingly, one of my first interviews in the hedge fund industry was with him and one of his partners, Rich Swift, probably 24 years ago or so.
So yeah. You posted this on Twitter.
Yeah.
I have no memory of it whatsoever.
I don't think I talked to you too much. It was more, I think Rich was looking for a junior.
Got it.
And he gave me like a battery company to analyze.
Okay. I forget.
I don't even know if there are any.
So I didn't want you to be insulted, but I was like, oh gosh, how did it go?
I think I talked to you for 20 minutes, but yeah, Rich had me doing some.
Got it. Okay.
But actually, that's a good segue. You know, I think I wanted to start with, you know, maybe you giving everybody a bit of your background, because you really came from the institutional world, ran a series of successful hedge funds, and then got into the research business, like you said, about half a decade ago. But I think, you know, starting even from, you know, why you got interested in investing would be interesting to people.
Okay, cool. I got interested in investing because I grew up real poor. my mother was an immigrant from Uruguay. My father was a Mexican-German, just Western person. Had a pretty tough childhood. I mean, we were homeless for a little bit and all that. I'll kind of skip ahead.
Yeah.
At the time that I was growing up, I'm 51 years old, the best way to become unpoor, if you didn't have any money, was to go to Wall Street. You know, I think now people talk about entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
That wasn't as big a thing. And so when I did my research coming out of high school, I saw that Wharton undergrad in the University of Pennsylvania was the best business school. Everyone, you know, Donald Trump went there. Warren Buffett went there. It turns out, I just found this out over this weekend, I didn't realize that Elon Musk went there at the same time I was there. Totally did not realize. So I got into Wharton, and basically when I was 16, 17, and decided I wanted to do stocks, did a couple things, worked in Tokyo, worked at Lehman, et cetera, for the summers. And then I started out in private equity. And about a year into that, this is right out of college, they fired my boss. And I was like, okay, well, I think I want to pick stocks, you know, because there were a couple investment clubs, one of which I co-founded Wharton Fellows Fund at Wharton. And I just love stock picking, and I love the game, and I love the competition. And, you know, I consider it the greatest mental competition that's ever been created by mankind. And so I was like, oh, should I go get an MBA? Should I go work, go research here? Did this? I'm like, what are you thinking? Like, I got all these friends who are already working at hedge funds. Why don't I go to a hedge fund? So I got my first hedge fund job in 1996 when I was 24 years old. I was a portfolio manager 18 months later when I was 26 years old, just in time for long-term capital, founded my first fund, the one you interviewed with.
Redco was where I interviewed.
Oh, okay. So that was actually another fund we were at before we founded Stadia.
Stadia, yeah.
We founded Stadia March of 2001, $585,000 under management.
Yeah.
Grew it to $1.4 billion in the next 4 years. I want to say in 2003, we were like the 87th largest hedge fund in the world or something. And then through the next 20 years, you know, founded a couple firms, co-founded some firms, I was a part of the founding team of a firm called Falcon Edge with Rick Gerson, Navar Zidwadia. And so, you know, great career. I've always enjoyed it. Do you want me to go to the...
Well, I was going to actually ask, you know, what were the strategies at all the firms? I mean, it was all long, short equity, right? And then... Were you focused on it? You're obviously a portfolio manager very quickly, but were you focused on any sectors along the way?
Well, I mean, I came out of fundamental long short, but my actual background was quant.
Yeah.
So the best way to explain it is that the funds that I eventually built were hybrid. They were fundamental long short bottoms up with raw material, with quantitative overlays on trading and portfolio and risk management.
Yeah.
Pretty similar to what you guys do. Yeah. The funny thing is we talk about this now. 20 years ago, that was like
nobody
did that. Like, you know, you were picking stocks, and if you weren't picking stocks, you know, because I also come out of basically the Tiger adjacent world, which, you know, there wasn't as much of a focus then on the quantitative side.
Yeah.
But historically, I kind of covered everything. I mean, I did a lot of media telecom, a lot of industrials. I did what we call capital intensive. So, you know, but I'd done financials. I'd done, you know, more or less all of it through time.
Yep. Gotcha. And then so you come to sort of the end of your hedge fund career, I think reconnect with Whitney Telson.
Well, so let's come to that. Like,
you had an entrepreneurial.
Yeah, stint. So my hedge fund career didn't really end. I was having a great time. You know, I was working with Rick at Falcon Edge. We were doing great and all that. I'd always done a lot of private equity deals, and I had a very interesting idea about content into commerce.
Yeah.
The idea that you could take media companies that were servicing passion areas like tennis or collectibles, or in our case, music, and then go and buy that company and use that audience and repurpose it for commerce, because now you had Shopify and 3PL and all that. So in 2016, I stepped away and created a music merchandise company where we bought up a bunch of music media, Revolver in rock and metal, Brooklyn Vegan, Alternative Press. We actually bought up a ton of stuff in the tattoo world. We owned Inked Magazine.
Oh.
We had $60 million on social. And then we built about a $20 million commerce business on top of that, which I just sold to the Madden Brothers from Good Charlotte about 6 months ago. So that's really kind of what took me away from the hedge fund business. But I was never not interested in investing.
Yep.
And so in 2019, and this will kind of get to what I think you really want to talk about, you know, my old friend Whitney Telson, who you know Whitney, very, very well-known hedge fund manager, very, very smart guy, exceptional human being. He had an education business, and we're having lunch, and he says, well, I'm going to close the education business, which, you know, I think.
And it was an investing education business?
Yeah, he basically was doing classes for people that wanted to start hedge funds or getting into professional investing. Yeah. And, you know, he also ran a big value conference. I think the business was doing well. But he says he's going to close it. I go, oh, what are you going to do? He goes, well, I'm going to start going to the investment newsletter business. And coming from the institutional world, I knew nothing about the investment newsletter business. I was like, penny stocks? Like, what are you talking about, Whitney? And he said, no, there's this guy named Porter Stansberry who 20 years ago started a technology letter, but he's built this incredible franchise that's, you know, and it's publicly available information, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's really high quality research that kind of takes really high quality ideas and concepts and puts them in language that anyone can understand.
Yeah.
And so I was intrigued because I like media businesses. This is the definition of content into commerce.
Yeah.
And I always liked writing and talking about ideas and everything. And so Whitney, I went out and got, I think I read 70 different notes from Stansberry.
Yeah.
And I was blown away. And I'll tell you what blew me away. I feel like a lot of institutional money management is a lot of extra work to justify the fees.
Yeah.
The reality is when you're looking at investing, trading, investing, stocks, et cetera, it's a very small group of things that really make the decision. And there's a group of maybe 15, 20 disciplines to have. And what the Stansberry guys did is they did a great job of just focusing on that. So who cared about, you know, the ARR for the quarter came in at 18.63%. It was supposed to come in at 17.24%.
Yeah.
You know, all these things. I understand why the Pods and Citadel and other are going to focus on that. But for a normal person, you shouldn't give a shit. You shouldn't pay any attention to it. And so I was blown away with that. The other thing is they had really good quality ideas. So basically, I said, Whitney, I love this idea. And so Whitney and I teamed up. He had just launched a business called Empire.
Yep.
We grew that to about $30 million of revenue, you know, very successful. And then last year, there were, you know, market-wise, Porter came back because he had stepped away for a bit.
Yeah, they kind of had some board-level dynamic
there's just a lot of moving pieces. Yep. I mean, I think everyone was very well-intentioned, and it's worked out great.
Yep.
But what happened in kind of when they decided to do a reorganization, our original mandate for Empire, which to me was to take this hedge fund level quality research, you know, what I was doing for CalPERS and Common Fund, and bring it to real people, they decided to close Empire and move us all over. And I basically went to Porter. I said, Porter, I'd really like to take this original vision forward because that's what I'm passionate about. And Porter said, great, go for it. Like, yeah. You know, go ahead, go and create your own organization. So we created HX Research just 4 months ago. We launched on February 1st. You can check us out at daily.hxresearch.net.
Yep.
And it's essentially what we're doing at Empire. And I'll finish with this and we can jump into other stuff. We have a daily that's free that comes out and talks about different topics in the market. Yeah.
And it could be the daily could, like, I think I saw one about NVIDIA the other day. Maybe.
Yeah, we spent this week talking about NVIDIA. We can talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's stuff that's evergreen that we can be doing. I'll tell you, today I literally brought back a piece that I wrote in 2021 about stocks.
Yeah.
Because the market is feeling a little stonky. And so I was like, I'm going to talk about stonks.
Just because Bitcoin's up, well, not stock market, but 9% again? Or
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even Bitcoin. It's like what's happening with DWAC and Super Micro and SMCI, whatever that is. But so we've got our daily, which is free. We've got Trader, which is equity trading, 30 to 60 days. We've got Income, which is an option strategy. And then we have what I call Legacy, which is basically the best of ideas. It's kind of what I was doing with my hedge fund. So there's long-term, there's short-term. But most of all, like, I'm going to give you this one last thing with HX, then we'll get into other stuff. There's the story that Jesus said, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach him how to fish, he eats for the rest of his life. I like to think of HX as this awesome fish restaurant that's very affordable with incredible fish that while you sit there and eat your delicious fish, you actually learn how to fish at the same time.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I want you coming back to the restaurant every day. You can go fishing on your own too. But honestly, for a lot of our investors, we tell them exactly when to enter, exactly when to get out. You can just sit there and eat the damn fish. It's a good deal. And that's kind of the ethos behind what we're doing.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about process. And I'm guessing each product's a little different. But maybe we start with the one that was most like your hedge fund. Like, what is the process? And is that every 2 weeks that comes out?
Yeah, I mean...
What is the process behind putting an idea in?
Yeah, so HX Legacy is actually once a month.
Oh, once a month.
We come up with one idea. Look, my starting point is this. I'm only interested in things that can double. There are hundreds of stocks each year that double.
Yeah.
There are 1,000 stocks that double across a three-year period in any given environment. So I'm incredibly uninterested in stuff that will do less than doubling. Yep. The second thing I look for is the risk-reward.
Yep.
So, and here's the thing. Some stocks can go up 5-10-fold, but they can also get cut in half or go to zero.
Yep.
And there's a place for that. Where we sit with Legacy, because I want to protect people's capital also, is what I call a 3-to-1 risk reward with the ability to at least double.
Yep.
If I can't convince myself a stock can do that in a couple years, then I'm not interested. So that just cuts out a ton of stuff right away.
And what do you have to see that convinces you that it could potentially double?
So I'm going to tell you.
I mean, it's probably different for every stock.
No, it's actually not. Like, I mean, look, let's talk about some physics or rules of the universe. If a company's earning a dollar and that company then goes and earns $10, the stock's going up. It's probably going up a lot.
Yeah.
It may go up sooner, it might go up later, it may go up the same amount, it may go up more, it may go up less. But you take earnings or whatever your relevant variable is, EBITDA, could be free cash flow. It might be revenue, but eventually it's going to come to earnings even if it's revenue.
Yeah.
Take a company, identify a company that's going to take EPS from 1 to 10, and you've got good raw material.
Yeah.
So we're very, and by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean we're just growth. Because if you take a cyclical that was earning $5 and now they're losing $2, they're going to go back to earning $5 and you have the same sort of equation.
Same
although I kind of prefer the secular growth and all that. So the first thing I do is I look at earnings and say, can they go from 1 to 10? And a lot of that then will be driven, I'll say there's two pieces of it. Number one is the fundamental TAM, the total addressable market. Does it make sense that they could actually grow from a dollar to 10?
Yeah.
There's a lot of industries where it just doesn't let's take the paper industry away from cyclicality. I just don't see it that paper companies are going to grow earnings from a dollar to 10 versus something like one of my favorite companies I love to talk about, which has struggled a bit in recent history, is Match.com.
Yeah.
Right. There's 20 million paid subscribers to Match.com. There's 1 billion people on this earth that would like to hook up.
Yeah.
Okay. That are on the internet that are available. Okay. There's probably 3 billion counting the unavailable ones.
Yeah.
Between,
oh, so a billion that are actually in theory single.
Well, you're more than that, right?
Looking for
there's
a
million people on the internet, and there's at least a billion that want to hook up, and they've got 20 million paid subscribers. So, and they're a market leader. To me, that number is going to 50 or 100 million at some point.
Yeah.
Now, yes, maybe it gets disaggregated by Meta or something, you know, but you get my point. You start with that big math. And then you've got a good starting point.
I think I just realized I'm single, obviously. I need to be on the market leader match.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Yeah.
Actually, do they own Bumble?
Oh, I don't know. Match.
I don't think I think Bumble is its own
actually,
company.
There's actually, they match out like 8 of these.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know they'd roll a bunch up.
Yeah. But so those are kind of the basics. I'll just put this one last thing is, and this is for all my strategies. I do like operational momentum.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because the corollary here is if you give me a company that's earning 10 and they're going to earn one, I'm going to tell you the stock's most likely going down.
Yeah.
Okay. Companies that meet and beat expectations and have rising estimates go up.
Yeah.
Okay. Rule of the universe. We could get into like expectations there. You just take me a rule. Yeah. You give me a company with good growth, again, cyclical, non-cyclical, recovery value, et cetera. Beating numbers and raising estimates, the stock's going to have an upward bias.
Yeah.
Flip it over, you miss numbers and estimates are going down and you've got negative earnings growth or a negative revenue, you have a bad stock. You might have a good short. Yeah. So, and I'll leave with this one thing. We only need 20 stocks in a long-term portfolio. That's actually the mathematical truth.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the biggest mistakes investors make is they're over-diversified / they're not selective enough.
Yeah.
You know, why not go through your portfolio? And look, there's rules for everything in a portfolio, okay? I understand that. But for a good portion of your portfolio, if you can't make the case the stocks can double in 2 to 5 years, get the hell out for a good portion of your portfolio. And again, that doesn't mean you're not paying attention to risk or any of that, but that's really legacy kind of sits in that that area.
Yeah.
We're actually going to have a free idea that we're going to come out with next week.
Oh,
that's a really interesting one. A company out of bankruptcy. That's one of the most valuable assets on the face of planet Earth, you know, things like that. So it is quite eclectic when you look at it. It's not all match.coms and huge TAMs and things like that.
But you're looking for something that can double. That's the primary.
Yeah, this one probably will just double or go up 150%, but the risk part is so incredibly low, their business is locked in, that I feel really comfortable with it.
How do you deal with this from doing this for a long time, but there's always, assuming we're doing it legally, which I know you are, there's unknowables, right? How do you get the comfort level to, like, what are, you know, on a very high level, parts of your process to get you to the comfort level to say, this should be one of my 20 stocks? Like, obviously you're going through the SEC filings, you're modeling it out, you're maybe talking to management, maybe not, but doing channel checks. Are there things that are part of your process?
I'm going to take this a very different manner.
Yeah.
First off, there's two ends to it. The first thing you have to understand in trading or investing, you're still dealing with probabilities.
Yeah.
So the best that we're doing, my dad was a professional gambler. He actually professionally gambled. He didn't make any money.
Yeah.
Lived in Nevada for 30 years. But I'm always fascinated with blackjack, right? You know, you play perfect blackjack, you're still, even if you don't count cards, you're still going to lose ever so much. But there are multiple times when you're playing perfect blackjack where you're going to make a bet that you'll actually more than likely lose, but it's important to play perfect blackjack. So the first thing I do is you got to understand, you're not going to get them all right. All we're trying to do is put ourselves in a position where our team out on the ice is all high probability bets.
Yep.
And then understand that some of them are going to fail. So, you know, perfection is the enemy of but anyways, you know, if you try to make everyone imperfect, you're going to fail. You have to accept failure.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing that we can't know. The second is, you know, just big math, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like some of this math is not that hard to understand.
Yeah.
I think Match is a great example. the company that we're going to do the free idea, I mean, I'll tease it a little bit, is actually a utility.
Oh, interesting.
So, like, I've got incredible visibility. I mean, you know, just try to understand those types of things.
Yeah.
The third component, so I'd say, number one, understand you're going to have failure. Number two, just look at the big math and the logic. I call it the common sense test, right?
Yeah.
You know, number three is I like to see operational momentum, okay? And what that is, you know, companies, they're teams. And, you know, when you look at teams, you can have great talent on the ice, and the team can just suck because they're not gelling and the management's not there, et cetera. The same thing happens with companies. You could have very good companies, and maybe it's because something's happening in the industry. Maybe they're just off tune. But, you know, you only need 20. Why have a bunch of companies that are missing the tune, that aren't dancing to the music? And again, this doesn't mean be momentum-oriented, and I could talk about those subjects too. But, like, I like to see operational momentum. I like to see companies beating numbers.
Yeah.
I like to see companies growing. You know, I like to see the turnaround. I like to wait for the whites of the eyes, you know, on a position, especially in trading. Because, again, there are 7,000 liquid stocks out there.
Yeah.
You don't have to get involved and catch a falling knife.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have to be done.
So that was actually a question I had. And you and I have talked about this offline, but stop losses.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, again, it's different for each of your products, but how do you think about implementing them or incorporating them, I guess, with this business and maybe when you're in a hedge fund business as well?
Yeah.
The
hedge fund one's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
We'll probably leave for a different different conversation. Because the other thing, too, in the hedge fund world, I had lots of shorts.
Yeah.
So when I walked out of Falconage, I had a $1.3 billion short book. I was one of the probably top 20 short books in the world. I mean, you know, for fundamental equity long short, you know, I spent 70% of my time on the short side. I made all my money on the long side.
Yeah.
What we do now, we don't go short.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy with that. What I'll say is this: it really breaks into investing and trading. And, you know, people who subscribe to our publications that are paid subscribers, and we've got a really good promotion going on right now. There's something called a primer where I actually, for my trading and investing, wrote like 40 page documents. I'll send them to you.
Yeah.
I think you might,
I might have them.
I'm not trying to, like, this will sound cheesy. I think you'll actually enjoy them.
Yeah.
For trading, what we really do is we look at an alpha oriented stop loss.
Yeah.
So what I don't want to do is have the market shake me out.
Yeah.
So if my position goes down more than 15-20%, versus the relative index, then I'll just stop myself out, no questions asked, okay? Because I'm really playing more sentiment, technicals, et cetera. And I found that once I get past that point vis-a-vis the market, minus 15%, my probability of getting back to flat or making money from there goes down quite a bit.
Yeah.
On investing, I will look at that, but then because I have longer time frames, I'm really looking at what I call the fundamental stop loss. Is either the story broken.
Yep.
So let's deal with Match.com. This is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Match.com, which we don't have an outstanding recommendation on. Match.com, you know, could be in a moment in time where they're facing competition. They're not. You could maybe be saturated. You're not. You know, maybe there's some technological change, but there hasn't been. Any of those things could happen, though. Like, they really could. Meta could just, Zuckerberg could go single and decide, I'm going to spend, you know, instead of screw the metaverse, I'm going to create the Zuckverse and stuff, you know, and spend $10 billion.
Right.
That would be a problem for Match. But then on the other side, so is the fundamental equation broken? It's about operational momentum. Match sucks right now. Like, they do not have the music. So Match is relatively uninteresting to me. It hits one of my big buttons, which is the big TAM, but they really don't have the execution. And I only need 20 stocks. I can find 20 stocks that have the TAM, the opportunity, and the execution. But that would be something where we would have stopped ourselves out of Match. And it's not on the first earnings miss, you know, but after a couple earnings misses, we just say, okay, we're just going to move on. Yep. So, and it's not, I guess,
it's always hard for investors to move on, though.
Well,
I guess what you're saying is you just have to apply a discipline to it.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is something different. Doesn't mean you're wrong about Match. It's just there's better stuff. If Match misses,
right, opportunity cost.
Yeah, if Match misses quarter, three, four quarters in a row, I'm gonna wait for them to beat the quarter for two times in a row before I come back in.
Yep.
Like, I know that sounds super momentum, but remember, if I'm there for 3-4 quarters, I was probably there for 16 months. So it's not like I'm a momentum guy. But again, Selectivity. I can't say it enough. You can always find something that has all the things you want in 2025 stocks.
What is it? What is the example of one that you guys like right now that sort of fits those parameters? Or I don't know how far you are into publishing either.
Yeah, so we don't give away free ideas.
Oh, okay, generally. Okay.
So, but I'll tell you this. We're going to give one away next week, a longer-term idea. But I've actually filmed a video this week. I'm going to talk a little bit about trading.
Yeah.
And I filmed a video this week we're going to release on Friday. It's actually going to be a free idea. I'm going to give it away here. I'm going to take away my own thunder. But we have a trading idea in Adobe. Okay. Oh. And just so you know, what trading means for us is we have a strategy, two strategies, trader and income. What trader does is we identify equities. I'm going to describe them in a second. We generally are looking for a 30 to 90 day holding period. We historically have had about a 75% hit rate, and the average return is about 9%. Okay. Actually, the average return for the whole thing is about 11%, but you know, you get about average for 9%. So it's a very high hit rate. And in 2022, these are crazy numbers. We had like 76, 77 ideas. They were all longs in 2022. Remember, the S&P was down 20, the NAS was down 30. We had a 72% hit rate, and we're up 8% with just long ideas. So what we're doing in that strategy is I want to find what I call winners. What's a winner? Well, what's the contest? The contest is the stock price. So a winner to me is a stock price that's gone up a lot. It looks like this, okay? Winners look like this. Losers look like this. So we start by looking for winners. We identify companies that look like this. Pull up the chart of Adobe. It looks awesome like that. Then we say, well, why has it been winning? Well, with Adobe, and I won't go too far into Adobe. We could, but I'm like, you know, they've grown earnings tremendously, tenfold since they moved to SaaS a decade ago. They have an incredible history of beating numbers. Results have gone, you know, our earnings estimates have just moved higher, higher, higher. So Adobe is the perfect definition of a winner. Adobe is one of the greatest tech stocks of all time, and they're continuing to grow. It's an awesome product, et cetera. So then that's great, but why are we interested? Because I wait for them to get kind of kicked in the ass and something to happen that gets the stock to statistically, materially oversold. How do we measure that? RSI. Overbought on RSI is not that useful. There are ways to use it.
For shorting, though?
For shorting. Yeah. Overbought on RSI is probably good. It's good for profit taking. I would never short it. In fact, the first time a stock goes overbought on RSI, probabilistically, you should probably buy more. But on the other side, an RSI below 30 is statistically significant for almost every business. And so we're looking for big liquid stocks that have awesome track records, that have been awesome stocks, awesome companies, that we wait for them to go below an RSI of 30 and then bounce back through. Remember, whites of the eyes.
Yeah.
So what happened to Adobe the other day? Okay. Sora. Remember what Sora was? The ChatGPT video thing with these freaky deaky videos. I was like, I was on acid when I'm watching these things. So Adobe, mind you, Adobe was up a ton. The NASDAQ's up. But the whole market needs to take a breather, in my opinion. We could talk about that. But the Sora news came out, and the stock was down 15%. Okay, got quickly oversold. And so I did some quick digging. Sora is not available for the public. Won't be available for a good long time. It's very much in beta. And it's not going to mean jack shit to Adobe anytime soon. I doubt it will ever mean anything to Adobe. I think that if Sora is good, Adobe will just license it and figure out a way to work on it. But none of that matters for trading, because all I needed to believe is that this stock that hit all my characteristics was going to just move back up. And so with Adobe, we actually recommended an HX Income selling puts on it, where people are up 50% on those puts from we recommended this last week. And now I'm stealing my own thunder. We're going to recommend buying the equity here in the next couple days. We'll put a video out on Friday. But I want to take a step back. The core of that trading strategy is very similar to the core of my investing strategy, right? We probably wouldn't buy Adobe in HX Legacy. Why? Because I don't really think it's going to double easily. Okay, so it's not interesting enough. But as a trading entity, oh my God, Adobe's like the awesomest. I mean, I have it in the report that we'll publish the free version on tomorrow or Friday, depending when I get out of here. they beat like the last 40 quarters, they beat 39 out of 40 quarters.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's just a great company. They're winners, you know, and so, but that gives you an example.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah. So, yeah, I wanted to go back to your thoughts on the market. You said earlier you think it needs a breather. What's making you think that right now? I mean, obviously there's some obvious things, but why, like, what's your rationale?
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, you know, look, let me take a step back. I'll give you both my intermediate and short term.
Because you did note stonks earlier and
stonks,
saying animal spirit stuff.
Animal spirits, without a doubt. I mean, look, let's go through some other basic math. You know, moving averages and distance from moving averages, those are a measurement of velocity and sentiment. And the fact is, mathematically, when a stock or a market is very extended from its moving averages, it is a mathematical truth that it will move back to its moving averages. There are two ways you can move back to your moving averages. You can go sideways, and the moving average will, if you've been going up, you're extended, the moving average is going to come up and meet you. There's actually three ways, right? You can go sideways, and the moving average comes up and meet you. You can come down, and then you meet the moving average. And the other one that's theoretically possible that has never happened is, well, you just go up less, and the moving average is, but you're still going up. It just doesn't happen. It's a very low probability bet. So we've had such a good run. Sentiment is so positive. There are so many stretched stocks out there. You know, we've started seeing these eruptions of DWAC is back, Digital World Acquisition Corp. You know, Bitcoin, I actually am a big fan of Bitcoin. But, you know, you're seeing SMCI, we talked about, you know, all these different things. And so to me, let me go to something more important, though. It's all about probability. Buy low, sell high. The hardest part of that is not the buy low. It's the sell high. And the key to buy low is selling high. When you've got these excess profits, maybe we'll talk about NVIDIA, because I think NVIDIA could be a great example.
I think NVIDIA is a great example.
Yeah. So when you've got these profits, just take some off the table. Now, some people will come back and say, well, what about taxes? Okay, well, I've got a couple answers. Number one, you know, is it a trading account or investing account? If it's a trading account, you can't worry about taxes, because that'll get you. Number two, I'm going to tell you this. Other than sitting on something where I'm up a 10 bagger, every single time where I took a short to intermediate term, meaning 18 months view of like, I'm not going to sell this for the tax because of the taxes, sell it. Because almost every single time, I ended up losing more money than I would have off the taxes. The minute that goes through your head, I should be selling this, but the taxes, well, now we've got a big yellow flag. Okay.
Right.
So let's take NVIDIA. Okay. We recommended at Empire, we recommended NVIDIA way back in 2000. I don't remember where, you know, it's up 1,200% since then. You know, we had a view on electric vehicles and all this, and autonomous vehicles and all this stuff. And we've been very positive on NVIDIA. I wrote two reports in my daily this week, Monday and Tuesday, were about NVIDIA. And my conclusion was this: at minimum, do nothing. Okay? If you're not involved, don't get involved. You know, and I made this analogy in there. The hottest club, you know, maybe the hottest club, but it's going to be crowded and sweaty and overpriced. And you're probably not going to have a good time. You know, yeah, you get to be seen, but like it's really not worth it. At this point, NVIDIA is the hottest club. And I'm going to come back to fundamentals in a second. Let's go to technicals. It's been super extended from the 50-day moving average. Again, no stock ever got infinite extended from the 50-day moving average. It catches up. The stock needs to take a breather. Third, we talk about animal spirits. We talk about sentiment. Oh my God, last week, the stock that will break the market. Like, I mean, I have seen things like that, but it's rare. I will also tell you, when I see that, take a break. do nothing. If you've got stock in it, take some profits. But let's go to the fundamentals. This is the part that no one's talking about on CNBC, because a lot of the stuff I just said, they kind of say, why did NVIDIA go up as much as it did?
Earnings went up tenfold.
Or no, not quite, but earnings estimates since last May went from, for 2024, went from 6 to 24.
Yeah.
Okay. They went up fourfold. Do you know how much NVIDIA's up in that period?
Probably about the same or more.
Fourfold.
Yeah.
So NVIDIA today is also a $2 trillion company. Okay. So should I be involved in NVIDIA? Will NVIDIA do the same thing? Well, to do the same thing, I have to believe that earnings are going to go from 6 to 24 to 100. Okay. I struggle with that. And that NVIDIA is going to go from 2 billion to 8 billion, by far the most valuable company in the world.
Trillion.
You know, those are low probability bets.
Yeah.
Now, could it still go up 50%? Could it double, et cetera? Maybe. But let's go all the way back to when you probably first met me. So during the dot-com bubble, people forget there was actually a lot of incredible stuff going on. The internet was being built out. The cable company started laying fiber and hybrid coax in the late 1990s. And there was all this money going into fiber and networking equipment, et cetera. Cisco went from, and this is in one of my reports, I'm going to get the numbers wrong off the top of my head, went from like $80 million in revenue to like $3 billion across like 5-10 years. There was also another company, Corning Glass, which was from the old glass company that literally made the Corningware, but they had the fiber optics, and they were blowing away numbers. Both Cisco and Corning were blowing away numbers like NVIDIA is today. And if you went to go try to buy networking equipment for Cisco or glass or fiber in the secondary market, it was trading at 3 to 4 times. You would pay 3 to 4 times what the list price was. That's exactly what's happening right now with the NVIDIA chips. But here's what happens next, okay? NVIDIA, let's say the chip's selling for $10,000 from them, but no one can get them. They're selling in the secondary market for $40,000. NVIDIA is highly incented to make more chips. They don't make that extra $30,000. They're also in a situation that the technology's not standing still. If they just stood there and didn't increase capacity, AMD and everyone else is going to come behind them with chips that are going to be competitive. Maybe they're not quite as good, but they're a lot cheaper. So all that demand, they're going to go away. So NVIDIA is by themselves making sure that they don't stay at these levels of kind of earnings because they're building the capacity. It's the right economic thing for them to do. But to me, what I look at, hyper demand for a product, because ultimately it's not a commodity because it's high technology, but you know, it's not like land. We can make more chips.
Right.
We make a chip factory, and then there's more chips, and then the supply's met. And by the way, once I had the chips installed, like I fundamentally do need less chips, even though there's big growth and all that. And so there's just a lot of yellow flags.
So what would you talked about seeing the whites of the eyes. Mostly that's on a long and operational momentum, but. And you've also made, I think, talked at times about sort of being done with shorting. I'm paraphrasing, but what would you have to see fundamentally to say, okay, NVIDIA is a short now? And maybe it's, is it the prices in the secondary market going down? Is it?
Yeah, it's a tough call. It's a tough call.
I mean, I know.
Let me tell you high confidence votes, high confidence bets. Okay, because I'm about probability, right? A high probability bet. If you're not involved in NVIDIA, don't get involved right now.
Yeah.
I think it's going to
be So start with that.
Let's start with that. That's the highest probability. Number two, if you're sitting on a big NVIDIA position, you haven't taken some profits, take some damn profits. I guarantee you.
Don't worry about taxes.
Yeah, don't worry about taxes. I wouldn't worry about that. You know, to actually short it, I mean, if I was really to get in that mindset, I'm going to tell you there's two things I would look at. One is technical, one is fundamental. I would wait for a break of the trend. Look at where it is versus the moving averages. And because here's the thing about momentum stocks. And this is actually the note that I'm publishing tomorrow. Because I went back to my stonks period. And today's note in HX Daily, daily.hxresearch.net, was about stonks. And how do you trade stonks? Like, how do you? Because there's a way to trade them. Like, I learned it the hard way back in the dot-com bubble. The next one's about momentum investing. And what you have to understand about momentum investing, momentum stocks never correct by going sideways. They only correct by going down.
Right.
Because at some point, the catalyst for a momentum stock going up further is that it's going up further. So the reason the person is buying it is because they have an expectation that it goes up further. They don't have an expectation about earnings. They don't have an expectation about fundamentals. They don't have an expectation about the Fed. They don't give a shit about any of that. They're just expecting to buy it at 600 and expect it to go to 700. And when it doesn't go to 700, because at some point it won't, they're just going to sell. They don't care about valuation. They don't care about the ticker. That's literally what momentum investing does. And in today's world, people like Millennium and the pods, they have strategies that are focused on doing that, very successful strategies. So you got to understand, when you're in a momentum stock, if they stop going up, they're going down.
Right.
That's just not every time, but just take it as a general rule. So from a trading perspective, I'd wait for some technical indicators to sort of go through there. From a fundamental perspective, you know, I do think you could look at, once they stop beating by, and they're already doing it, right?
Yeah.
The level of the beats are decreasing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's going to turn into a period of consolidation. I went, and you know, we're February 29th, where I put on Twitter, I actually feel pretty strong on this one. I think that there's a good chance that NVIDIA's seen its highs for the year in the month of February, okay? And again, NVIDIA's an awesome company. And I want to get back to this. For our strategies, let me just say this. NVIDIA's a giant do-nothing. 99.9% of stocks are do-nothings.
Right.
Okay? The most important decision you can make in trading and investing is deciding to do nothing, not doing something, you know? And so I just think that for NVIDIA, I just wouldn't be involved at this point. You know, it's fine. I'll take my popcorn and watch everyone else.
Yeah. I like that. Last question for you. I asked this to I've had three or four guests now, I'll ask it to everybody, but somebody that's new to investing, right? You know, you sort of started when you were 16 or 17, went to Wharton, great place to learn, but what would you recommend to somebody that's completely new to it, wants to start investing, wants to eventually, you know, put more of their money to work when they make money? Like, what are the sort of high level things people should be doing?
Well, I'll take a step back. I'm going to go Charlie Munger on you.
Yeah.
The single post that I have pinned on my Twitter profile, Enrique Abeta, is a reading list. And, you know, look, I went to Wharton. Wharton was great. I learned much more at Wharton from my classmates and being surrounded by it. There used to be a Bloomberg machine down in the basement of Steinberg Dietrich, and there were about 20 of us. I had no money, but I'd still do it because I was literally phantom trading a paper account, was that interested in it. There were like 20 of us that used to just go in between classes and look at the Bloomberg machine. That group has managed over $1 trillion. My point is, I learned more from hanging out with that group than I actually did at Wharton. But the great thing about reading is there's a ton of great investment books out there. The Market Wizards books, you know, like, well, yeah, actually,
I agree with that.
How to Make Money in Stocks by William O'Neill, the Market Wizards books, you know, all of these things. There's this incredible group of knowledge out there that you can't get anywhere else. Education about finance and investing is terrible in this country. I'm actually working on a group of children's books about famous investors because I feel like education, like finance education has turned into sex education. It used to be we couldn't talk about sex with kids. Now you can talk about whatever you want on sex, 43 different genders, you know, which is cool and all that. But you talk to a sixth grader and you say, oh, well, I want to teach them basic accounting. People are like, oh, you can't spoil their childhood. Teach them about something they can actually use in life. My point being, Munger had his whole thing about just read. I would just read 30 books. I have 10 of them up on my Twitter profile.
Yeah.
A couple of the things that we say at HX, trade a lot or don't trade at all. Don't be caught in the middle. If you're trading, you're trading. If you're investing, you're investing. What the worst thing you can do is, well, I'm an investor, but now it's going against me. Now I'm going to trade it. That's just like, that's the killer of all funds.
Yeah.
Do the work, you know. Go in, do the research. You don't have to be right. You don't have to be right about it. Doing the work is going to create the conviction.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets to this final one, which I love, is plan the trade, trade the plan. When you go in, have a plan. What is your plan? What's your exit plan? Why are you in it? What is your expectation? You know, oh, Bob at the club said I should be buying this stock. Okay, well, that's probably not going to work out very well, you know, because you don't have a plan. You haven't done any work, you know, and you don't know what you're doing. So, you know, I'd say those are kind of my pithy, you know, trade a lot or don't trade at all, do the work and plan the trade, trade the plan.
Actually, I forgot, I had one more question for you, and we talked about this before, but, you know, a big mistake that you've made in investing, what you got wrong, why, and then how maybe your process adapted, although maybe it's a situation where it was a fraud and you didn't know or couldn't know.
My biggest loss of the last few years, which I'm very well known for, unfortunately, is Voyager Digital.
Yeah.
But you know what? I don't really have any regrets there, and I'll tell you why. The portfolios that we were putting that in were very high return, high risk. We recommended the stock at 5. It went to 10. We told people to sell half. We continued to recommend the stock, and then obviously it went away. It's difficult when you're dealing with financials because they're a black box.
It's opaque.
That was a situation where management literally, we said, are you doing A, B, C, D, and E? We and everyone else. And they said, no, of course we're not doing A, B, C, D, and E. And they were doing A, B, C, D, and E.
Yeah.
So I don't know that there's a lesson to be learned from my worst mistake of the last 5 years. But I will say this, it's position sizing.
Position sizing.
Trading discipline, et cetera.
So risk management.
And I guess that probably comes down to it. Like, you can be wrong. Like, we knew what we were doing. We knew, like, you can't go into a stock that you think can go up tenfold without knowing that it's got a chance to go to zero. I'm just telling you, everything that's gone, Tesla, like, you know, NVIDIA, people forget, NVIDIA almost went bankrupt back in the day. You don't get 10, 20, 30 baggers. Now, at some point, they get past that point. So, you know, that's probably the biggest lesson is position sizing, trading, you know.
And I guess in that instance, you know, a stop loss would have helped, right?
Yeah, but it was difficult because, like, there was no, like, we wouldn't have been using a technical stop loss because it wasn't a technical position. It was a fundamental position.
Right.
And, you know, they misrepresented, you know, and that's just going to happen.
Yeah.
So what's the key there? Position sizing and trading.
Yeah.
People who followed our initial recommendation actually got out with all their capital.
Yeah.
Okay. People who got there later weren't in that same position. But that one stung, and I take full responsibility for that one. And that's one thing that, you know, in the hedge fund world, it's a lesson in life too. You know, things are going to blow up.
Yeah.
And you know what you do? You sit around the table, you say, why did this happen? What happened here? What did we get wrong? Okay. What do we do right now about it? And that's the first group of conversations. Then we have a second group of conversations where we say, what is systematic about this? Was there something that we're doing that is a systematic error that we've repeated? Is there a way to put process in place here, you know, et cetera? And that's why I guess I'm kind of getting with Voyager. I don't know if there's a lot I would do different, you know, in terms of the
I guess what you wouldn't do is trust that management team again.
Well, yeah, of course, but you don't know.
But you don't know that. Just
don't
know that.
You know, the guy had come from whatever, E-Trade. He had a good
background. Yeah.
But, you know, look, that just gets to position sizing. If these two things, know what you're doing, right? We were playing for big returns, and to play in big returns, those companies, by definition, can go out of business and then just size it and trade it right.
Yep.
And then that's how you deal. That's how you have a systematic process in place to deal with the certainty of failure. Because remember, in investing and trading, you have a certainty of failure. I guarantee you're going to fail, and you're going to fail a lot. And how you manage that failure is actually as important, if not more important, to your eventual success than the successes that you have.
That's awesome. That's a great place to wrap it up. Thanks, Rick. We really appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. If you don't follow Rick on Twitter, I recommend you do it. Check out his new company. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.